public hearing on the Department of State lands for this day, Thursday, February 17th, 2005. Welcome to all from the Division of State Lands staff, and welcome to the House members who are all here on time. Same cannot be said for our Senate counterparts, but that's okay. All right. Director Hannes, great to have you here. For the record, why don't you go ahead and get started with your presentation?
Thank you, Representative.
Oh, and before we go any further, members, we have a lot of performance measures to go through, so Director Hannes is going to go quickly through the overview. I'd ask you to keep your questions at a minimum, because we have 29 performance measures to go through, some of which will be aggregated in one particular slide. But we have a lot of questions, and it's going to take us some time to accomplish that. Please get started.
Thank
Director,
you.
Thank you.
Thank
for
you.
The record, state your name.
Sure. Thank you, Representative Krupp, members of the subcommittee. For the record, my name is Ann Hannes. I'm the director of the Department of State Lands, and I'd also like to introduce my staff members that are here with me today. Steve Purchase. Steve is an assistant director in charge of field operations. John Lilly, who is assistant director in charge of policy and planning. Jeanette Holman, who is in charge of finance and administration, assistant director. And Pamela Constantopoulos, who is my finance manager. So let me start. I'm going to be giving you the phase one presentation with the agency overview, and then I'll go into performance measures, our priorities, and reductions. The mission of the agency is to ensure a legacy for Oregonians and their public schools through sound stewardship of lands, wetlands, waterways, unclaimed property, estates, and the Common School Fund. Looking at the purpose of our agency, we serve as the administrative arm of the Land Board. That's the governor, the secretary of state, and the treasurer. We manage Common School Fund assets. This includes lands and waterways granted at statehood in 1859, as well as unclaimed property and estates with no heirs or wills. We protect and conserve state waterways and wetlands. We also manage the South Slough National Estuary and Reserve, which is located just south of Coos Bay, and the Natural Heritage Advisory Council. Some major initiatives that we've been embarked on. One is to boost the overall size of the Common School Fund. This will directly send money to the schools. We're doing this through more aggressive land management, through land sales. For example, the Land Board just approved 13 sales for us to proceed with at the last Land Board meeting. These are essentially isolated tracts that are difficult to manage. We should realize about $500,000 from those 13 sales alone. We're also pursuing in-lieu federal lands. These are about 3,200 acres of lands that are still owed the state since statehood, and we're going after parcels that would yield a high value for the Common School Fund. And then lastly, with the unclaimed property, we've been working on boosting receipts and getting claims paid out. We're also proposing that the unclaimed property program be transferred to the treasurer's office, and I'll be talking about that more a little bit later. Further, we're looking at trying to protect the Common School Fund assets. This includes revising our asset management plan, which is basically the strategic plan for how we manage our real estate portfolio, the revision of the Elliott Forest Management Plan, as well as hazardous waste cleanup. And this is especially true with the Portland Harbor. In terms of agency initiatives, we've also been striving to improve customer service through extensive outreach and training. We've also are now a member of the Economic Revitalization Team that was formerly the Community Solutions Team, and we've been actively involved with certification of industrial lands. We're also planning a reorganization of the agency that I'll talk a little bit more about. We've been involved with removal fill streamlining, use of technology to really further those efforts, as well as customer service surveys. Our current organization, which you'll find behind tab one of your book, has the director's office and then three divisions, which include field operations, policy and planning, and finance and administration. South Slough reports to the director, and the Oregon Natural Heritage Advisory Council is also one that's part of the agency. under the planned agency organization that hope will take effect no later than the first of the biennium, will include new three new divisions, which are essentially the Land Management Division, the Wetland, and that'll be headed by Steve Purchase, the Wetlands and Waterway Conservation Division, which will be headed by John Lilly, and Finance and Administration, which would also include our Information Technology, Rules Coordination, Estates, as well as Finance and Accounting and Legislative Coordination, and that would be headed by Jeanette Holman. South SLU would continue to report to the director, as well as including the Natural Heritage Advisory Council. And as I mentioned, the transfer would take place of unclaimed property to the Treasury. A bill will likely be introduced soon, and that transfer will be accomplished through a legislative change. The Land Board has the responsibility, according to the Constitution, of managing common school fund lands consistent with the conservation of this resource under sound techniques of land management. This was further underscored by an attorney general opinion that was issued in 1992. It's commonly called the Crookham opinion. And under the Crookham opinion, it said that management responsibilities require the state land board to obtain full market value from the sale, rental, or other use of the Admission Act lands while conserving the corpus of the trust. And this is important because this also guides what our land management activities have to strive for as we benefit the common school.
For the benefit of our newly arrived Senate members, I've asked Director Hannes to be relatively brief in her presentation of the overview because there are 29 performance measures that will take up the bulk of our time today and tomorrow. So certainly feel free to ask questions, but let's try to keep them, as a minimum during the overview. Yes, Senator Sheehan.
You said today and tomorrow?
Today and Monday. My apologies, and thank you for correcting me, Senator.
Yeah, I was just wondering if I was going to have to cancel everything in district.
Well, please continue.
Thank you. Also, with regard to the Common School Fund, the Common School Fund I really view as a total portfolio. It includes not only the amount of assets that are managed by the Treasurer and the Oregon Investment Council, and that totals around $900 million, but also all the real estate that makes up that portfolio as well. And the agency programs within the Department of State Lands contribute to the Common School Fund. Let's talk now a little bit about how the Common School Fund actually works. Can you just stand up a second? The constitutional revenue that I talked to flows into the Common School Fund as the principal. That includes like range lands and forest lands, revenue that we get from that. Statutory revenue could be like waterway leases from docks, marinas, floating homes. Also flowing into here are the receipts for unclaimed property that are held in trust. The principal of that $900 million that I mentioned is invested in stocks and bonds. And then it's the earnings that flow out of that principal that's then distributed to schools. And from the revenues and from the earnings is what we deduct our expenses from.
And just briefly, unclaimed property held in trust, is the trust earned interest?
Yes. There's about $180 million right now of unclaimed property of the $900 million. And so one of the benefits of the Common School Fund is that's invested just like every other part of the Common School Fund. It's just held in perpetuity.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Also on the Common School Fund, I mentioned that it's invested in stocks and bonds, about 70% stocks, 30% bonds. The value of that has really fluctuated over the last 4 years. It hit a low of around $600 million when 9/11 occurred and the stock market fell significantly. And most recently, I'm really pleased that it has climbed and even exceeded an all-time high of $911 million. I'm going to turn now to land management. We manage forest land. Let me come over here a second. We manage 133,000 acres of forest land. The largest chunk here is the Elliott State Forest. We manage over 600,000 acres of rangeland. These black areas here are rangeland.
You also have a map of that connected to your PowerPoint presentation. And then we have scattered tracks throughout the state that we also manage, as well as 800,000 acres of waterways and 3 miles out of the territorial seas. The other land management that is our responsibility is all state-owned mineral rights, including exploration and production leases. This map here highlights a lot of the different activities that we're involved in from a land management standpoint. And you can see it's a really diverse set of activities, from fiber optic cables that have come into the coast, and we've received money from those fiber optic cables, to harvesting off of the Elliott State Forest. New Carissa was ours because it was sitting on the bed of the territorial sea. Houseboats we manage because they're on the bed in the banks of the, for example, the Willamette River. Gravel mining that comes out of the rivers. We have agricultural leases. For example, we have a lease that's right near the Columbia River that's a poplar farm that you're driving along I-84. We get easements from transmission towers, communication leases, and rangelands. This slide highlights the kind of activities we get involved with, from agricultural lands and rangelands with the different types of forage leases, for example, and rangelands and easements, industrial, commercial, residential property. The most prominent of that is the building that our department is in. We lease the rest of that space to other tenants, and the rent from that space goes into the common school fund. And then forest lands, we're also various easements and leases on that, in addition to the timber harvesting that takes place. In terms of waterway management, this also details the kind of activities that take place on waterways and the type of mineral activities that we do. For example, the one hard mineral lease that we have is, we call it our kitty litter mine, which is in Malheur County because it has diatomaceous earth, and we get royalties from that. So it's a whole range of different activities that we're involved with. Okay, forest land. The Department of Forestry is under contract to the land board and the agency to manage common school fund lands. This is about 133,000 acres. I mentioned the primary tract of land is 85,000 acres near Coos Bay, and that nets out about $22 million for the biennium. One of the things that the last legislative session asked us to do was a cost-benefit study on the Elliott State Forest, and I believe each of you were delivered a copy of that cost-benefit study. In a nutshell, according to the study that was done by Mason, Bruce, and Girard, it found that the forest at the Elliott was valued somewhere between $265 million and $489 million. That really depended on the type of entity that would buy it. They looked at four different entities. Timberland Investment Management Organization, they're the ones that have been most active, and they buy it for pension funds. A REIT, a real estate investment trust, they're kind of a mutual fund type trust. A large manufacturer and a medium-sized manufacturer. So depending on who would buy it and what their rate of return was that they expected, the bottom line that Mason, Bruce, and Girard found was that there would be a range of about $136 million loss to the Common School Fund to a gain of about $206 million. Removal fill program. This removal fill program, we process permits for the removal and fill of materials in wetlands and waterways. We get almost about 1,400 applications a year. The overall purpose of this is to protect, conserve, and make the best use of water resources, to protect public navigation, fishery, and recreation use, to ensure that activities of one landowner don't adversely affect another landowner, and then also, importantly, to minimize flooding, improve water quality, and provide fish and wildlife habitat. For unclaimed property, the Department of State Lands is the trust holder of abandoned funds when the rightful owner can't be found. This ranges from payroll checks that aren't claimed, safety deposit boxes. Sometime you should come over to the agency and see all that we have in our vault there, because it ranges from, coins and jewelry. We've had baseball signed by the greats. We've had false teeth. We've had all kinds of things in safety deposit boxes. Pretty interesting. But anyway, we hold those until we can find the rightful owner. And that's often important as a consumer protection measure, because sometimes we often get dormant bank accounts, for example, and we'll get a dormant account of somebody's whole retirement. And it is not unusual to get somebody's entire, like an elderly couple's entire retirement savings that then we can return to them. Now, as I mentioned, in the meantime, until we find the rightful owner, we hold this in trust in the Common School Fund, and it benefits our schools in the meantime. I mentioned that we're proposing a transfer to the Treasurer's Office. 30 states in the country do have unclaimed property programs within the Treasurer's Office, and we're seeing more and more, I think especially as you have corporations that have become multi-state corporations and multinational corporations, that unclaimed property is becoming more and more an issue. It's not a small amount of money, because as you can see, in 2004, we had about $30 million in unclaimed property that we collected, and $8 million of that was returned. We've had situations, for example, where a bank that's not an Oregon bank but does business here in Oregon has sent unclaimed property to its parent state, like in Ohio, and that means that Oregonians lose out on not being able to know where to find their unclaimed property, and the state of Ohio benefits, and our schools lose. And those issues more and more are playing out on the national level. The National Association of State Treasurers is the one that is really working on that, and the unclaimed property administrators are connected with that.
Yes, Representative Dinkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question about the potential transfer to the Treasurer's Office, and does that, two questions, that would, the money would stay in the state school fund and be managed by the Treasurer's Office?
Correct. It would be the management that would be transferred, and there would still be the link to the Common School Fund. That wouldn't change.
And a follow-up?
Yes.
And would that take a change in statute to do that?
Yes, it would. And you should be seeing a bill on that soon, okay, being introduced.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Estate administration. This deals with estates where there is no will or heir. We search for the heirs. We inventory. We protect the estate assets. We pay out claims against the estate, and we file with the probate court. So, in a sense, we are the administrator for these estates. We've had over the 2003-05 biennium, we've had about 125 cases so far. About half of those we end up finding heirs for, and about half of them will probably eventually escheat to the Common School Fund. And that has amounted to date for this biennium of about $1.2 million. The South Slough National Estuary and Reserve, this is about 4,800 acres. Again, it's located down near Coos Bay by Charleston. It is managed for research and education on estuary ecosystems and restoration. We get a large number of visitors there every year, and it's becoming an important tourism draw, as well as the benefits that it provides to the coastal community for education and research. About 6,000 kids visit South Slough each year, and they use it as an outdoor learning institute. They've been engaged in important research on estuaries, on oyster culture, for example, that's benefited the business there, tidal marsh classification, water quality. We have some very dedicated volunteers that have volunteered about 13,000 hours biennially. One of the proposals that I'm very excited about is to have a co-location of the administrative office with the Charleston Merchants Association. It's strongly supported by the local community, and this is one that would be located within Charleston. It would serve as a visitor center, and it would help provide information to visitors. Another activity that South SLU has been involved with is really trying to increase its outreach to schools. One of the things that was really fun that they engaged in was Estuary Live. This was a webcast that occurred and was broadcast to schools not only throughout the state but internationally as well. And the individual there that's on the left is Tom Gaskell, who's in charge of our education program. The Natural Heritage Advisory Council is a council that advises the state land board. They develop a plan that highlights natural heritage areas. It's basically the best statewide ecological overview of the state that currently exists, and it's been used, and it's important and used by not only other state agencies, but also local and federal agencies as well, other organizations and consultants. In addition, they nominate on a strictly voluntary basis land to be included in a registry that highlights important and unique ecological sites. I'm going to turn now to the removal fill program once again, because I want to highlight some of the initiatives that have occurred in the removal fill program over the last 2 years that I think you may want to be aware of. The first one is the statewide programmatic general permit. This is one of the major streamlining efforts we're trying to do with the removal fill program. The statewide programmatic general permit, or SPGP as you may have heard of it, is one that we're working on with the Army Corps of Engineers. It's one we've been working on for quite a while. We hope that we're actually going to get it signed this spring. We're actually very, very close to that. It would include 8 different categories. These categories include stream bank protection, road construction, repair and improvement, site preparation and construction of buildings, stream and wetland restoration, minor fills and removals, water control structures for fish passage, utility lines and piling installation and removal. And it would eliminate a lot of duplication between the state and federal. Not entirely, but I think it would be a benefit to applicants. The other thing it would do, which would be a first nationwide, is that if you can get a permit through us, through the SPGP, then you would also know that you have Endangered Species Act protection in addition, and that is a first nationwide.
Yes, Representative Shoffman.
On the utility lines, as far as the transmission of power, aren't there special land use laws there, or do they have to go through this whole thing? There's a lot of talk in the Pacific Northwest about challenges of transmitting electricity up and down the West.
Representative Schaffer, this really deals with any removal fill activities connected with, say, if you have to dig a utility trench or a line, not the transmission of power itself. Another area that we've been actively working on is to see how we can expedite permits. And one of the ways that we've been doing that is by putting forth 2 new general authorizations. And general authorizations differ from an individual permit process because they are more expedited permit process. We've done a general authorization for the ODOT bridge program so that they can more quickly get a permit, as well as one for small wetland fills. And this has greatly helped people that aren't doing very large projects. We've also put placer and prospector permits online, and that's been very popular, as well as putting the removal fill permit process online. And that, I think, has been a great benefit to applicants because you can see where your permit is at. It doesn't kind of go into a black hole. You can go online, find out where you are in the permit process, who's commented and what they've said, so you know exactly where you are. We've done extensive outreach to groups. We've had training and outreach all over the state. We've put on training for 48 different groups and reached almost 1,400 attendees over the last 2 years. And I think you're going to see when we get to the performance measures that that has truly had an impact on being able to process permits quickly and efficiently, as well as people really being able to understand what's needed in the permit. The next area I want to talk about is preparing industrial lands for development. We've initiated a rapid assessment for industrial certification sites. This has included more than 70 sites that have been assessed to date. We've done an expedited review for wetland delineations for industrial certifications and assigned this as one of DSL's highest priorities. And we provided technical assistance to certification sites on wetland avoidance, minimization, and mitigation planning. When we've been involved with preparing industrial sites for development, we've been involved with the 23 sites that have been certified to date, as well as 47 sites that are anticipated to be done by June of 2005. I mean, examples of some of these sites, I think, are ones that you may all be aware of. For example, the Lebanon Industrial Site, the Boeing Industrial Site in Gresham, Amy's Kitchen in Medford, the Sutherland Industrial Site, the International Paper Site in Gardner, and the Happy Valley Rock Creek Industrial Site. This is also, I think, where it shows that we've had a direct connection with the Economic Revitalization Team and the role we've played. I'm ready to...
All right, time to go to performance measures.
Go to performance measures.
That's under tab 2, members?
Right.
Actually, it's under tab 2D.
2D. It's the, you'll see the green divider.
Okay, why don't you go ahead and get started?
Great, thank you. I'm going to be going through 29 total performance measures today. 15 of those measures were added by the 2003 legislature. In a nutshell, we're meeting or exceeding 12 of the measures. We're very close to meeting 3 of them. We're not meeting 2 of them, and we're developing data on 12 of the measures. I also want to emphasize that what you're seeing here today is performance measure information through June of 2004. So in some cases, there's limited information, or I'll also be able to provide you after the performance measure some additional information that will help with understanding the performance or add to that. We've used these performance measures in our management decisions and our strategic plan. And we've also used them in budget development and program priorities. The first performance measure I'm going to talk about, and this is on page 143 to 144, behind tab 2D. This is a measure of the percent of annual increase in revenues from all sources for the Common School Fund. Our target was 1.5%, and we've actually realized a 24% gain. This includes all sources generated by agency activities. It doesn't include stock gains in the Common School Fund, however. The overall goal of this performance measure...
Now, wait a moment. That's an amazing swing. You're saying that's not reflective of stock gains?
Right. And what I... And this is percent changes. One of the reasons for the large change has to do with the forest receipts that come in, because the forest prices have changed dramatically over the last, as well as an increase in the harvest level. So that's been one of the reasons. The other reason particularly in the last year, we've become more aggressive on our land management.
How much money does that represent? In terms of a swing in?
Well, let me give you a total amount. In 2003, the total amount of revenue that was generated was $17 million. And in 2004, it was $24.5 million. And 2005 is actually, doing really well this year. So for the fiscal year 2005 through December, we have about $32 million in so far. And that's because of turnaround with timber harvest, but also because of the activities that DSL has been doing.
Yes, Representative Krieger.
Is there much of a change in the far as forest management plan of rotation ages or thinnings compared to clear cuts? Or
I don't think that there's been much change in terms of the overall age of the harvest. Some of it, I think, like in 2004, the timber harvest was about $10 million of that $24 million, and to date, the timber harvest is about $15 million of the $33 million. Some of it is the timing of when the sales may occur, and some of it is also, are timber prices up or are they down?
Okay. And why are your targets so low? Is that, do you have any historical perspective there that's leading you to believe that those targets are going to remain consistent like that?
I think in the future we may want to think about, you know, when we have a little more data, to be able to do maybe a longer range target. We may want to think of perhaps in line with what our long-term return is on the Common School Fund, and that might be in the range of 6-7% per year. I'm not sure yet. If I were to recommend it today, I'd say maybe we bump up the target to 6-7%. I think you're going to have a lot, you know, from when you look at a year to year, you'll have an awful lot of swings because of those different market conditions or the timing of things. Over the long term, I would hope we could sustain an overall increases.
Yes, Representative Krieger.
And underneath the, we did, I think you were still there, the definition of greatest permanent value, the purpose of lands rule as it applied to state forest ground, but I don't believe that same definition applied to the common school, did it?
No, that rule, as you're thinking of, is what was what Gowney's governs the Board of Forestry
That's
lands.
That's right. What I'm saying here is that these lands, you have a different constitutional direction on what these are supposed to do, and how would you describe the management that you're required to do on that to achieve those goals of revenue?
We have a mandate legally to maximize revenue over the long term for the Common School Fund based on long-term sustainability. And so we need to manage that aggressively. And I'd say there's probably even a stronger trust requirement than even the Board of Forestry Lands, because not only is there a constitutional basis for the Common School Fund, but there's also a link to the Admissions Act, which is much stronger.
And they're very different, aren't they?
They are.
Question for you. I don't think I articulated my question to you correctly. That chart says percent of annual increase in revenues from all sources. That includes all of your types of sources of revenue, including stock market gains or losses?
It does not include stock market gains or losses.
Okay,
it includes,
so then you shouldn't say from all sources.
That's probably correct.
Look, I'm just a farm boy, but that means all. All means all to me.
If we really wanted to capture it all, we could do that. What we were trying to see here is, you know, more of the types of activities that we had some more control over than what we might have with the stock market.
So how does it look with the stock market then?
The last couple of weeks have looked pretty good.
Well, here's what I'd like to have you do. Chair Morgan and I discussed this on this measurement. We'd like to have you come back in phase two with a, or perhaps on Monday if you can, on this particular performance measure, if you could disaggregate these sources of income and list them separately and show them by a category, if you would please, all of your income streams into the Common School Fund.
I think what Pamela, should we be able to, can we do that by Monday?
Yes, we have
Okay, very good. That'd be very good. And at the same time, then, also show us the net dollars into the common school fund. After all expenses, management fees, administrative costs, we're very interested in that's an incredible swing in a 12-month time period or a 24-month, depending on how you define it. And what we're interested in knowing, especially since you do have income from the stock market, and the stock market has done very well in the last couple of weeks, that we look at what is the actual net into the fund.
Right. Is an
important measure that we'd like to see.
Okay.
If you could.
We'll do that.
That'd be great. Members, further questions about performance measure number one? In this portion, by the way, feel free to ask all the questions you want about performance measures. Representative Dinkfelder.
Thank you. Two questions. I'm a little confused based on the answer that you gave Representative Krupp. If you look down on the 1, 2, 3, 4th question for bullet point where you say compare actual performance to target and explain any variance, and it says the agency met this goal for 2004, and then the second part says the large variance is due to major fluctuations in the stock market. So I'm really confused.
Yeah. And I'm sorry, that should not have said in here that it was due to the fluctuation of the stock market.
So it should say it's not due, or it does not include. Okay.
Yeah, and that is an error. I'm sorry. I should point that out. Now, one of the things that is in this measure does include the interest generated by some of our unclaimed property.
Can I follow up?
Yes, please.
The last bullet point, which says what needs to be done as a result of this analysis, and I think some of this will come out when you get the information that Representative Krupp requested, and you list some of these sources. One of them is looking at the number of leases and assessing fair market value. So would you be able to provide that, or you're saying the agency still needs to do that analysis?
No, I think what Representative Krupp, Representative Dingfeld, what that is saying is that these are things that if we want to increase the revenue coming in, we need to increase the number of lessees under lease, for example, on waterway leases to ensure that we've got everybody under lease, because we don't have everybody under lease right now. We've been actively working to get that to happen, as well as looking at whether or not what we're getting when we charge is whether we're getting fair market value.
Okay. And sure. Follow up. So how do you decide what to charge?
Representative Krupp, Representative Dingfeld, we try to do a market analysis. For example, if we have communication sites, we may look at what somebody, a private individual, charges for having a cell phone communication site on their property and try to do a market analysis. Sometimes it's tough because it's not always easy to compare the types of lands, but that's what we try to do.
Okay. I could follow up, but I'm not.
Well, a good point, and I'd like to follow up with Representative Dingfelder's question in terms of, and before they go, I want to say goodbye to my friends from Lebanon. Thank you all for coming. Hope you enjoyed your day here, and we'll see you again. That's the chair's prerogative. Those are constituents of mine from Lebanon High School government class that are here today, and it's been great to have them. In regards to... Are you in the process today of trying to increase the number of leases? Do you have an active program in increasing that? I know you're reevaluating many of the market factors in play there, but what are you actually doing to increase the number of leases?
I'll answer that, and then I'm
leases,
also
leases rather.
I'll answer that, and I'll also have Steve Purchase come up and talk about it too. One of the things that we've done is we've reassigned two staff into the proprietary area so that they can focus on leases. And we've also been working through the inventory that we have on waterway leases to ensure that people are under lease. So let me turn it over to Steve, and he can talk about that.
Good morning, committee. Representative Krupp, members of the committee. Steve Purchase, Assistant Director of Field Operations. Director Hannes picked up on it very quickly, what we are doing. We did reassign two staff, but we also did a fairly extensive waterway leasing inventory in 1998 about all structures on our state-owned waterways, whether they were docks, they were commercial leases, They were easement activities such as riprap banks, communication lines, what have you. And we're working off of that inventory right now, and that's one of our performance measures that we'll talk about later that we've been working on for several years. We were also fortunate last session to get a couple of limited duration positions on our property side that have focused on trespass issues on the east side of the Cascades with communication site leases that were there without authorization. We've got a lot of those already under lease and functioning. We have identified folks who have removed gravel from our state-owned uplands and in some cases the waterways without benefit of lease. We got those folks under lease. The biggest land management activity that we're working on right now for leasing and dock registrations is the dock registration program. We have sent out this biennium over 800 notices to folks on waterways who have small personal docks on the waterways. So we're very active in that arena. I'm surprised more if you haven't heard about that. I'm sure you have. But we've been very active in going out and getting those folks under registration and leases, and we're working to continue to work forward to that.
Very good. Senator?
I love this stuff. Can you give us a couple anecdotal stories? Like you talk about gravel without being leased, somebody just kind of wandered off in the hills and decided to load up a bunch of gravel. What are some of the biggest places where the state has lost out because it has an asset that somebody's decided to help themselves to? That's one question, and then I'll follow up with another one.
There's a couple of issues I would relate to. One is that we have had in eastern Oregon, we have a lot of our uplands, our rangelands have actual gravel deposits on them. Some people go in there and just assume that's public land, that gravel can be removed for their personal use, and they've done that. We've tracked most of that down. Another example would be, depending on the county that you're in, a county is an open range or a closed range county. If you're an open range county, you're allowed to graze cattle, and if you don't want those cattle grazed on your land, you have to fence it off. People have gone onto our state lands and grazed their cattle there without authorization or permission. Other ones that are on the west side are folks who are on our state waterways without benefit of authorization. I just dealt with one this morning who said they had a 200-square-foot dock, private dock on the state waterway, and it wound up being a 4,000-foot floating home. we were able to resolve that, not to their satisfaction, but to our satisfaction. So those are kind of anecdotal about what we see.
Yeah, a little bit difference between a 200-foot dock and a 4,000.
That's a slight difference.
Yeah.
It was an easy one to sort out.
Yeah. With the follow-up question.
Absolutely.
A minute ago you referred to a communications tower or something that wasn't leased. I mean, do people, companies or whatever, actually go out there and stick something up as a communications tower without bothering to lease the land first? I mean, that really happens?
Yes, sir. It really happened. We have 24 active communication site leases. The biggest issue for us is when we lease our site to a operator, it is not unusual to find out that they have subleased or allowed other antennas or structures to be placed within their leasehold and forgot to tell us about that. So one of the things we do when we make a site inspection is we check to make sure that whether it's a waterway user, a communication site leaser, a rancher, that they are utilizing the property in accordance with the contract that they have with the state. And that is one of the things that we've been really successful at in this last year about getting people to pay for what they're really using on state ground. So it does happen.
That's pretty good. And all this goes to benefit the school fund and stuff like that.
Yes, it does.
What's the biggest ripoff you've seen in terms of money or gravel? Or you pick the category.
Is he writing a book or what?
No, this ought to be a little bit of this. Anyway, ought to be on the record.
You can.
Well, the biggest one probably goes back about 100 years ago, and that was I think I talked to a couple of you about during about the first 50, 60 years of the state, that there was an active program to divest themselves of lands, and that was done legally and up front. But also there was a whole lot of fraud and graft at the time. And it culminated in 1908 with a major land fraud trial that sent 30 public officials to jail including our U.S. Senator at the time, and had we retained most of those lands that we lost fraudulently, we probably wouldn't have the kind of school funding problem we have today.
How much land was that?
What was the total?
At statehood, we received 4.5 million acres. Today, we have about 800,000 acres of upland left. Not all of that was frauded from us. A lot of it was sold. Land boards in the past sold land for little or no money.
But there's a book about that that you can get in the state library that's actually a fairly rare book. Yeah. That's called Looters of the Public Domain.
Looters of the Public Domain.
Write that one down.
That sounds like interesting bedtime reading. I'll have to race Representative Dingfelder to the library to get it.
It was actually written by one of the perpetrators from his jail cell.
Oh, no.
Well, that'd be called an expert witness.
Absolutely. Representative Shoffler, you have a question.
Thank you. These folks, is there any way for them possibly to get a permit to dig gravel and then not be leasing? Can that happen?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shoffler, yes. In our agency, we have two charges. We have the responsibility for the removal fill program, that is the issuing of the authorization of the permit that allows you to remove the gravel through the permitting program. If it is a state-owned water body, then we also have to make a proprietary decision as to whether or not we want that to occur and whether the royalties will be assessed. One of the things I would follow up with Senator Shields' questions about where we have opportunities to lose money is the legislature directs us on certain statutory lands on what we will charge and what will be exempt. Gravel is a very good example. There are three or four exemptions from royalty in state statute today from a state-owned water body. You can get a permit, but we can't charge royalty. We may grant the permit, but decide that the for other issues that we don't want that gravel to be removed or don't want to have to authorize that. And that's something we look at in our asset management plan and other activities.
Senator.
Sorry, this brings up a serious issue for me. Those are in statute. Does the statute always keep up with the latest in EPA or whatever environmental regulations that might have come down?
Representative Croft, Senator Shields, I'm going to give you my opinion, which is no, it doesn't.
Rebel City.
Yes.
I'm serious. What the consequence of that could be could have a negative impact on us. Shouldn't we be making sure that our leasing program doesn't run afoul of federal law, for instance? You know, excuse me, I need more information, but...
Well, I would think, that's a good question, Senator, but I would think the Attorney General's office, who gives them advice, ought to be able to answer those questions for them.
President Croft, if I may, Senator Shields, I didn't want to leave you the false impression, but we, as a gravel issue, we go through our removal fill program. And we go through our removal fill program and issue a permit to remove gravel. We also, at the same time, coordinate with all the agencies for those impacts to make sure that the activity that we permit does not have a harmful impact on water resources of the state, the fish habitat, the public trust values, and all those other charges that we're charged with under the removal fill program. And that includes coordinating with the federal agencies. Now, the federal side, the Corps of Engineers also may issue a permit for gravel fills particularly, but that is worked through the process to try to minimize any damage, ecologic damage or environmental damage that may occur from that gravel removal.
Another example is on the Elliott State Forest. When we harvest timber, we also have to harvest timber in compliance with the State Forest Practices Act as well as the Federal Endangered Species Act.
Representative Shoffler.
I don't have any problem with making statute conform with environmental policy, federal policy or state. My question is, if somebody does get a permit or a lease or both and they're out in the waterway or the forest and they do something that does not comply with EPA standards or our standards, clearly if someone is monitoring that, they could be shut down and forced to comply with those standards, correct?
That is correct.
Right. Okay, very good. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Let's move to performance measure number two. At this rate, we'll be done by midweek next week.
Maybe you
we'll
shouldn't have said
tomorrow.
We could ask
you
questions.
You said ask all.
I know.
Yeah,
well, I'll learn someday.
Not too soon, you know.
The next one is the percent annual increase in the number of unclaimed property owners who report and remit annually. Now, holders are those businesses and or employers that submit unclaimed property to Department of State Lands. This is showing that our target was at 3% increase. We actually achieved a 7.8% increase, and this, I believe, is an indication of the outreach that we've been doing in unclaimed property. We've had seminars throughout the state. We've had newsletter mailings. We also have an unclaimed property technical advisory committee, and that group has been very active, and they've put in articles in their own newsletters to try to spread awareness of the program. This is one where this performance measure, I should say, used to say the total number of holders, and it was so difficult to figure out who really is a holder, because if you look at, like, the Secretary of State information, they have a lot of different businesses that are classified. We only require those to file reports with us that have unclaimed property, not businesses that don't have unclaimed property. So there are a lot of businesses that wouldn't even need to report to us. So it didn't seem like as meaningful as to be able to say the percent increase in the number of holders that report.
Just to clarify, a business that's a holder of unclaimed property could be like a bank that is holding on to several deceased people's safe deposit boxes or accounts or whatever, or what other illustrations can you give me? I don't understand.
Representative Krupp, Senator Shields, it could be a bank, like, say, U.S. Bank or Umpqua, you know, bank that has dormant bank accounts. It could be an employer. It could be the state of Oregon. It could be Nike that has payroll checks that aren't claimed. You know, it's a variety of different sources.
Okay.
Okay.
Continue, please.
Thank you. These two aren't necessarily performance measures, but we thought we would put them in because we do feel that they're measures of effectiveness. This is showing the receipts coming in for the unclaimed property as well as the total claims that are being paid out. On the left-hand column, on the left-hand chart there, you can see that receipts have actually jumped up by 29 to 29.5 million. This is a 43% jump from the five-year average, and the claims are up $8.1 million. Now, there are a couple things that are going on here. One, I do believe that increase in the amount of receipts is really a result of the outreach effort that we've done. Plus, we've had a number of articles in the paper, and some national programs that have happened. And talk about claims, for example. For example, when there was I think it was on Dateline, there was a show that ran about claiming your money. We had so many hits on the state's website that it brought down the entire state's website. We've also had some TV slots, and we've had news articles that have highlighted money that's been returned back. And I guess that this is maybe a little advertisement, but I'd urge you to go to our website at www.oregonstatelands.org. And check out to see whether or not you have money coming to you. When I first became director, they ran one on me, and lo and behold, my husband had an expense check that he didn't know was coming to him, about $68, and he went out and bought another grinder. He had four of them already. I couldn't figure out why he needed another grinder. You know, when I say that to men, they just, of course he needs a new grinder. You know, so anyway, you may be surprised that either, you know, you or your parents or any other folks that you might have relatives may have money coming to them. Anyway, that was a very large jump in claims. The other thing that I want to point out is that one of the things that we've done over the last particularly the last 4 years. You'll notice that we had in claims, you know, a reduction that took place over a couple years. We were going through some major changes in that program. It became apparent not long after I became director that there were some problems that we really needed to correct in terms of fiscal controls. We had an audit that was done. We instituted major changes in fiscal controls, and we had a change in management. And I think the results of all of that are now really paying off. And then in terms of the amount of receipts coming in, I think that's a result of the outreach that we've been doing to holders. So. Let me talk about the next one. This goes into the percent of users of DSL lands and waterways. This is on pages 147 to 148. This is also, I think Steve Purchase was talking about this one earlier. The goal of this is to increase the overall return into the Common School Fund, and it's really an indicator of the number of users under lease or other authorization to use property based on what we have in our existing inventory. So basically are people paying for use of Common School Fund land. In this one, we did exceed our target. The target was 58%. It came in at 62%. Our target is going to be ramping up over the years ahead. I think this also reflects the additional staff that we've dedicated to this, as well as the position that the legislature granted us in the last session. And so I'm hoping that it's looking like revenues are going to be even better this year.
And these users are users that are under a lease or contract with DSL?
These are, yes, under use or contract. Let me have Steve come on up, and he can also answer these questions for you, too.
The reason I ask you that is because I do appreciate that you are, in 2007, you're showing a 90% compliance. Why are you starting at 58% and going up to 90? Have you not traditionally been able to achieve a higher level of fees from people who actually have a contract with you?
Representative Croft, members of the committee, yes, that's partly true and partly not true. And let me try to explain that.
Okay.
If we have a contract with, let's say, a gravel operator, where in our state contract, a gravel operator is required to pay us 20 days after removal of the gravel from the water body. And they submit a report to us that says, I took 10,000 yards, and if it's 30 cents a yard, you pay the appropriate fee. But when we do our audit, we find in many cases they didn't pay everything that was due to the state. That's why we have our most of our leases in those arenas audited on an annual basis. The second part of the question is that part of this performance measure was really intended to also capture is how many people are on our state lands who should be under lease paying the fees, whether they're appropriate or whether they're the correct fees, at any given time. And that's where we did our waterway leasing inventory as that example. 1998, we did an inventory of all the western Oregon coastal lakes and water bodies where we found all these structures on the water body that were there without authorization. They were paying no fees. And through that effort, we have gotten those folks under lease, and they are paying the appropriate fees based on our administrative rules. Now, it's important to remember this data was a snapshot in time in September of 2004. Since then, we have made significant changes and progress in getting people under lease. And I'm going to be happy to report, I think, that we're going to far exceed our 75% target in 2005.
Okay, outstanding. Go ahead, Representative Shaw.
Okay, I have a lease, a permit to dig out gravel out of the waterway, and I come in and I pay for taking out X amount of yards, but really I took X plus 10. You know, you penalize them when you find out? Do they pay a penalty when you find out they took out more than they said, and didn't you pay you the proper amount?
Representative Croft, Representative Schaffer, not in all cases. The state statute does not allow us to assess civil penalties for certain things, and we can for certain activities we can't. So in the case of a gravel operator, if they're within their permitted amount and within their lease amount for total gravel removal, we simply require them to pay the additional cost. We don't add a penalty to that. Our other leases have late charges and penalty charges for not reporting correctly.
Thank you.
Okay. And do you have a measure of what you think the income levels will be? Is it, I forget, out of 29 performance measures. If you get to 90% in 07, do you have a measure of what that income level is? You have that projected anywhere?
Representative Krupp, we'd have to project that out.
Would you please? Because that may also be one of the measures we take a look at, is measuring net revenue into the CSF Common School Fund based on this particular performance measure right here.
Great. Thank you.
Senator Nelson, you... No?
Nope.
You look like you were just pondering.
I was thinking.
Okay. All right. Well, if there's no further questions, why don't we go ahead and move to the next performance measure.
These are actually performance measures 4 through 12. There are 9 measures that were added in the 2003 legislative session. These are ones that have specific revenue and expenditure streams that would be matched up. We have had to revamp our accounting system in order to be able to actually have data for these performance measures. And we are, one of the things that we're in the process of doing right now, for example, in order to be able to do that, is that we're tracking our hours that staff is spending by source, because one person may not be dedicated to one type of source of revenue. And so we have to be able to figure out, you know, how much time that person is spending on each of the different types of revenue sources. We are we're going to have a new chart of accounts. And when we have that, we can put that into place at the beginning of the 05-07 biennium, so that then we'll be able to capture this data and we'll have it for the streams of rangeland, timber, waterways, agricultural land, special use, minerals, escheated estates, industrial and commercial, and removal and fill. But we do not have that data right now.
Do you have targets?
Mm-hmm.
Because we have to be able to see the discrepancy. It's hard to establish targets if we don't even have baseline data yet.
Okay. So you don't have. Well, you've answered it. Representative Dingfeld.
Well, and just to follow up on where Representative Krupp is going, I mean, I guess if we want to maximize money going into the Common School Fund, then I would think we would want to have a fairly high target on all of these to have full cost recovery.
Representative Krupp, Representative Dingfeld, yes, I think we need to be, you know, aggressive on there, but I also need to have some baseline data to even know what some of those targets can be, because some of these different activities will generate different types of rate of returns.
And
for example, rangeland grazing will not generate the same kind of rate of return as what we might get for timber harvesting.
Right. And you need to be realistic about it, too. Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. Do you have, one person that does rangeland and grazing and one person that does timber harvest? Or is there many people working on all of these all at the same time?
Representative Krupp, Representative Schaffler, most often we have people working on a number of different revenue sources. We do have one rangeland person, and only one rangeland person, so that one's fairly easy to dedicate his time to. But in other cases, we may have somebody who's working on waterway leases, but they're also working on upland and communication site leases as well. Or they may be... they may also be providing some work on monitoring forest harvest and the revenue coming in, as well as looking at an internal audit. So that's why we've actually had to go in and even myself, on a monthly basis now, I've been tracking the hours on what I spend on various programs, so we can then have some idea of how we allocate and where our expenses are going to.
Yes, Representative.
You know,
when I was in the laborers union, I was working for a contractor, we had to, and I drive around to more than one job site, so I had to mark off my hours on that. We had a job number. Is that how you're doing it, something like that now? And we were not doing that in the past?
That is correct.
Okay.
And it's a large amount of work to be able to have people. If you've done that, you know that it's a lot of tracking time.
When will you have concluded your time allocation study?
Maybe Pamela Constantopoulos come here. She's come on up. She's the finance manager, and she's been conducting the study.
Chair Krupp, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Pamela Constantopoulos. I'm the fiscal manager for State Lands. We expect to have that study completed by the end of 2005. What we wanted to do was take a fairly large snapshot of time because the seasonal nature of many of our businesses, such as rangeland grazing, there may be more work done during the summer months than there would be during the winter. So it's a full year study that we're doing.
Okay, and you started that study when?
At the end of 2004, sir.
At the end of 2004. All right. Okay, very good. Members, additional questions here? All right, so 4 through 12, you don't have the data for that for the obvious reason. Now, with number 5, are you going to use, it's talking about percent of timber harvest revenue stream. Are you going to work off your data, or do you work off the forestry's data?
We would be applying not only the expenses that forestry has, I believe, in answering this one, but also any of the time or expenses we'd have in managing forest land, because we track forestry expenses. We meet with them. We're active with the development of the Elliott Forest Management Plan. But in addition to the lands that are managed by the Department of Forestry, we also have a number of of tracts throughout the state that we call decertified tracts. They're no longer ones that the Department of Forestry manages, but we manage them. So there is some time that we end up devoting to that.
Okay. Very good. All right, let's move along then to number
13,
I believe. Just to make sure I don't have any additional questions listed on my sheets.
Performance measure 13 is the percent of DSL lands and waterways with completed resource inventories. This is a direct indicator of how the agency is progressing toward having the basic data collected in order to complete area management plans for state-owned land. And this is kind of characterized this as, just how do you eat an elephant, kind of one bite at a time with the amount of data we need to collect for all of our lands. In 2004, for example, on 770,000 acres of land, we collected information on tax lots, mineral rights, size and acres of our land parcels, latitude, longitude, and rangeland conditions for 60,000 acres out of the 640,000 rangeland acres. In 2005, what we're planning to do is look at all water improvements that have been made, the kind of vegetation, topography, its estimated value, its current use, its site condition, street address, and in relation to ceded tribal land, for example. We are behind with what we had hoped to achieve. The target was 60%. Our data actually shows that we've done 20%. And some of this is just, I think, a shortage of staff and not being able to do as much as what we hoped.
So then do you think that you need to revise your targets downward?
We might. Right now I kind of want to stick with that and see whether or not we can catch up on it and how we do over the next 2 years. We've tried to revamp some so we can capture that data more, as well as we'll see how things go with the reorganization, I'd just would like to wait a year or two before I'd say yes. Definitely I'd like to get that up over time. Because
yeah,
I think it's important.
Think so.
It's hard to be able to manage land effectively without having the data layers to really see what that means. And that may be one where we'll see how it goes in the next year, if we make a lot of progress, or we may have to come back in the next session and either lower our target or come back and say we need to have additional help to try to do that, for example, in GIS.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, just a quick
yes.
question on that. Do you typically do this in-house, Ann, or do you contract out for those services?
I mean,
it's a one-time thing, then you could look at, you know, 70 sites and contract out, and then you can update periodically.
Representative Krupp, Representative Dingfeld, we've actually done both. We have one person that's dedicated for GIS in-house, but on the rangeland conditions, we've contracted some of that out, and then we also, when we contracted out, we trained staff, and we've also been using some seasonal help there. So, yes, I think that, you know, contracting could, but we're, you know, there's only so much you can do, because some of the data layers can be fairly expensive. Some of it just takes being able to have somebody on the ground doing the inventories. Some of it we can pay and buy data layers from someone else.
Please, John, do you have anything to add?
Okay.
Thank you.
So before you go any further, it says what needs to be done as a result of this analysis, bottom of the page. It says this data indicates the department must increase the rate it completes resource inventory. So if your inability to complete and reach your target is because you don't staff or don't have staff to accomplish that, then what's your plan to accomplish it? Do you want to add staff, or do you want to reorganize? I know you have a reorg going on in the department. How are you going to fix this problem?
Well, you know, a couple of things. You know, one is the reorganization may help. Two is that we are going to be devoting some of our money that we have to contract out to be able to do some of that additionally in the next biennium. You know, that's
pretty much
that's pretty much how we're going to try to tackle it. One of the things I do want to make a correction on, there was an error in this sheet on page 167. It
okay.
showed 20% in 02 and 03. That's a typo. That was not included there.
So it should be NA?
It should be NA, and then the 20% should have started with 2004.
2004, okay. So both of those should be NA. Okay. All right, let's move on to number 14.
The second measure that is here is the percent of DSL lands and waterways with completed area management plans and policies. This is really reflecting of large plans that we have, like the Elliott State Plan, and we're also currently revising the Asset Management Plan. Some of the large land masses that we have that we really need to have overall plans on are our rangelands, and it's hard to be able to do those rangelands without having all the rangeland data associated with them. So that's one of the reasons why we don't have plans for all of it, but 73% is pretty close to what our target is. And I also just want to make a note, I'm sorry there's an error on this one. There was 60% that was under 2002, and that was a typo there. That should just be an NA there.
Okay. And, Ann, how come no progress in 03 and 04? You're static at 73% in both of those years.
Because we're still working on the Elliott State Forest Plan. That one is not complete yet, so that's the same. But we're essentially static because we can't complete a large range plan without having all the data, which we just talked about in the previous performance measure. So one holds us back by not having that.
Okay, Representative Shoffler?
Nope, that was the question. Why is it static?
Oh, great. Great minds think alike. Okay, any additional questions? Now, you are expecting, of course, to get another 3,200 acres in reading your narrative here to come into the common school. These are additional lands, and these are no-cost acquisitions from Bureau of Land Management, BLM, because they. You want to describe why we're going to get 3,200 acres of federal land for free?
Sure.
It's a good deal, but I need to understand why.
As I mentioned, when at statehood, we got two sections out of every township, so basically 2 square miles out of every 36-square-mile area. At the time of statehood, when those were surveyed, the survey techniques were not as refined as what they are today. Furthermore, that's putting it gently, there were some areas where those sections were already occupied. Say there might be have been an Indian reservation there, or somebody may have occupied it for some reason or another. There was a court case that was settled about 15 years ago, a long-standing court case that was finally settled. And that court case finally determined that the state was owed, I think at that time was it 5,200 acres. We've claimed some of those 5,200 acres. One of the most prominent claims that we made was Section 11 that's outside of Bend, which we are probably going to look at developing in the next couple years, and that's going to be a major asset for the Common School Fund.
Now, what do you mean by develop?
Develop by industrial, commercial, residential property.
And you will manage that or just sell it and put the money in the CSF, Common School Fund?
Maybe actually a combination of both. If it's residential property, we would likely sell it. If it's commercial industrial, we could very well lease it and realize lease payments rather than actually selling the land. One of the things that was fascinating to me, I've been attending the Western States Land Commissioners meetings over the last several years and seeing how states have become pretty aggressive in managing their common school fund lands. For example, I heard a presentation on how Montana and Colorado have lands that they're actually have had office buildings, commercial property built on their lands. In Arizona, for example, they have some incredibly valuable property that is now bordering Phoenix, that they've put a large Marriott resort, a shopping mall, light industrial, and they continue to own the land, and they've then leased that out long term to developers, and then that has realized a significant return for their common school fund.
So before I take Senator Shields' question, so then the question I would beg is we're going to come up with another 3,200 acres of land from the BLM, and this performance measure is percent of DSL lands and waterways with completed area management plans or policies. So what's your time frame then? How many years out is it going to take you to get to 100%, especially if we're acquiring new lands?
Going to take quite a while. I do anticipate that, like on those in lieu lands, like Section 11 will be one where we'll have a management plan on that. We do have one that's older now, and we're in the process of updating it. But those 3,200 acres, we would have management plans on those. But it's to be able to do it all at once now would simply be too expensive.
And last question before I take Senator Shields' question is how long is it taking to get 73%?
If John or Steve can tell that. Do you have any idea? John said 130 years.
I thought he would say something like that. All right, Senator Shields.
Well, I'm just fascinated by your story there of Phoenix. And it leads me to ask, what do the best states in the country look like in terms of management practices and getting return on their money or their land or their assets for the state school funds? I mean, I don't know if there is such a performance measure, but if we're returning X percentage per dollar that we have captured, are there other states that are way ahead of us? And are they ahead of us because they've essentially got a Marriott sitting on a piece of their land and they're getting a lot better return than us? I mean, are there things that we can learn from other states or not?
Representative Pope Center, sure. I think that's an excellent question. Some of the states are ahead of us in terms of being much more aggressive on, say, commercial industrial development. Some of the states have done an incredible turnaround, like Utah, totally revamped its common school fund management of its lands. Now, they were way behind most other states in the way in which they managed their lands. It was safe to say they were not managing it for the benefit of the schools, but they completely changed the way in which that was done, and now they are very aggressive in terms of doing, for example, open competitive auctions for their land sales and exchanges, ensuring that they get market rates for things. I think the education beneficiaries have become much more active. There's now a new education beneficiaries group called the Children's Land Alliance Supporting Schools, also known as CLASS, that have become very active in wanting to make sure that the common school fund lands in states are being managed for the benefit of the schools. I think Oregon is considered, has been on the forefront of states in terms of its asset management. We were one of the first states to have an asset management plan. We've also been working with trying to establish and put into rule so that it's very clear about what our rates are for different lands. We have, you know, we've definitely been ramping up our land management over the last 4 to 5 years in terms of what we're going to be doing. And that's been, I think, helpful that the legislature has granted us a couple positions to be able to do that where we hadn't been able to do that before.
Representative Krueger and then Representative Schock.
Representative Schaffer would like to know how a casino would work on the
Yeah, I'd consider it a gamble.
Game told me not to go there.
Depends where you want to go to help schools.
Well, that's true.
Depends on what slot you're working
on. Right.
Go right ahead.
My question. Okay, every now and then I get a letter from some state agency saying they're looking for property around my district to buy a building or an office. You coordinate this available land with, for example, if we had a state need for a state building in Bend, and we could build a building on that, on some land and consolidate any state agencies there, do you coordinate all that? Do you advertise it? Does everybody know what's going on so we could save some money maybe?
Representative Schaffler, yes, we do. In fact, one of the things that we are talking about, you know, with some of the other state agencies in Bend is, you know, would it be a good idea to do a state office building on our Section 11? You know, I don't know. That's one of the things that we have to determine with a plan, but certainly, you know, they would be pretty stable clients to have as tenants in a building, and it would be, I think, a win-win for the state. Part of what we'd have to look at is that the best return and is that the best use of that parcel? We have actually had, we've had other situations where we have leased land to other state agencies or sold it. Like I think the military department, we did a lease to the military department. We sold a tract of land to Metro for open space. But again, you know, we either had to have a proviso or make sure that it was being sold at fair market value.
Mr. Chair, I want to comment just briefly. You know, if we're going to let the tribes go off reservation land and build casinos, you know what? What better, what more lucrative client could you find? Now, that's a can of worms. But you know what? Hey, we are desperate for money. Why not? If we're going to go down that road.
Well, I think it's a great way to finance a new baseball stadium downtown Portland.
Well, it, you know,
older than me. I didn't
personally, I have a daughter in seventh grade, and I have a teacher, so I hear about it every night.
Fair enough. All right, let's. If there's no more questions or comments, let's move on to number 15, please.
Okay. Now we're getting into more of the removal fill program. This is looking at number 16, and that's on page 172. Is looking at the number of acres increased annually. For,
wait a moment.
Oh, I'm sorry, no, that number 15, sorry, on page 171. Sorry about that. Annual gain or loss in acres of freshwater wetlands. The target here was zero because that reflects the overall state policy of a no net loss. It's linked to the benchmark goal number 3 of maintaining and restoring wetlands. The removal fill program is intended to prevent a no-net loss. The statutory requirement is to maintain a stable base of wetlands through the mitigation of losses of wetland resources. So some of the gain here that you see of the 16 acres does reflect the creation and restoration of wetlands.
And for curiosities, why, I mean, one of your later performance measures, actually several of them, deal with wetlands and the importance of creating more wetlands for wetlands mitigation banking. How come you don't have a target established other than zero in the assuming years? I would think you would want to have a target to, I'm talking about a gain. You would want to have a net gain. I understand that the goal is a no net loss, and that's fine, but I would think you would want to have a target up slightly to try to get to that a positive situation.
This does not, I should say, reflect activities that may be, you know, a restoration that's done. This is in connection with the removal fill program.
So it really should be just loss.
So it really is trying to avoid loss of wetlands. I think that's correct.
Yes.
Now, for whatever reason you lose one, don't you have to mitigate for that and add two? Is that true? And if that's so, how come it's all of them aren't above zero?
Representative Krupp, Representative Schaffler, because it depends on the type of mitigation that's taking place for that respective permit. You can do a number of different types of mitigation. You can do mitigation that's on site. You can do mitigation off site, or you can do an in-lieu payment, or you can buy a credit in a mitigation bank. So there's a variety of different ways you can do it.
Over time, if you're using a wetland mitigation, and you're doing 1-1, 1-2, 1-3, tell us about how you gain actual wetlands by doing that.
You're
going to have a gain, aren't you?
You should have a gain, and I think this does reflect, you know, somewhat of that by having a gain because of the mitigation ratios, and the mitigation ratios are determined based on, I guess, the probability of success, depending on what type of mitigation you use. So, for example, if you're restoring, it's a 1 acre for 1 acre. If you're going to be doing creation of a wetland, then it's 1.5 acres of created wetland to 1 acre of impacted wetland. When there have been studies that have been done over time, it's much riskier and higher probability of failure of creating enhancing or creating a wetland than it is restoring a wetland.
Right.
Move on. The next one is
before you go away from that, how have you been able to create in 02, 03, and 04 those numbers of acres of wetlands? And this really gets back to my original question. You've been able to demonstrate that you can create additional wetlands. How did that happen And why is that not a consideration again in establishing a higher target?
And that may be something we want to do. I think if it's as a policy that we want to have a net gain of wetlands as we go through the removal fill program, then we would want to set that target higher. I think what we were trying to do is reflect what the law is requiring us to do and whether or not we're meeting that law.
Okay, so how did that happen?
I'm going to ask John Lilly to come up and talk about it.
Okay, John, for the record, state your name, please.
John Lilly, Assistant Director, Department of State Lands. This benchmark is largely driven by the number of permits that are applied for and by the choice that the applicant makes and the method for mitigation that they choose. So if in those, and I'm not 100% familiar with the source data for all of the information here, but in 0203, it may reflect that there were more permits for wetland fills, and consequently, maybe more of the applicants chose to do creation rather than restoration, and as a result, you saw a greater number of acres of gain. I think Ann mentioned as well that we're not tallying enhancement acres,
right?
For obvious reasons, because what you're doing is you're not really gaining in wetland; you're gaining in a better functioning wetland.
Yes, Representative Dinkfeld.
Well, I'm thinking that maybe we need to change the performance measure to truly reflect and say annual loss. I mean, if the goal is no net loss, maybe you have a separate performance measure like you do in the next one for numbers increased. And I had a question about that, but because it is confusing. I mean, either that or there needs to be two different targets, because one target is zero, that's no net loss, and the other target may be trying to increase.
Right.
Because it's confusing the way it is here, so maybe it means, I understand, because the law, you're consistent with federal law that says the no net loss policy.
It's state law, actually.
So.
Right, and I would be open to that. I just, you know, but that's the reason why we set it at zero.
Okay.
Fair enough. There should be no prohibition from you under the state law, and I understand you're trying to reflect the intent of the law by
right.
keeping it at zero, but is there any reason you can't raise it?
No, we could have a higher target for ourselves.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, so we could be above what we are, you know, the minimum required statutorily.
Fair
yes.
enough. Well, take that into consideration. I think that would be worthy of considering, and I think it's a worthy goal. Is looking at that in the removal fill program as an opportunity to increase wetlands, and you know, maybe it doesn't have to be a large goal, but I would think a small increase every year would be an appropriate goal and would be a good direction. So,
okay, thank you.
Yes, Representative Krieger.
To do what he just said is going to incur greater cost of businesses that have to do wetland mitigation. Buying the land, 1-to-1, 2-to-1, wherever it is. So if you've got an acre and you want to increase it, those acres are going to become more valuable for mitigation, and the costs are going to go up.
Representative Krieger, possibly, or to try to figure out ways to make sure that within the ratios that we have, that those wetlands are more successful. Either, you know, through additional scientific research or additional monitoring to make sure that we can track when there might be invasive plant species coming in, or if there's plant mortality, or that there's a proper hydrology.
But he brings up a good point. In these cases where you've had a number of permittees, and they have. They've used different methods mm-hmm. of mitigation. Those were their choices. Primarily, it was they decided which way to make. It was a voluntary choice for them to go which direction they wanted to.
And that is correct.
It wasn't you as the agency saying, no, we want you to create
right.
X amount. It was really their choice.
And we felt that it's been important to provide to applicants, you know, several different options that they could use to try to meet the requirements of the mitigation.
So, point well taken. It could increase somebody's cost if they chose to go a particular direction in terms of methodology for mitigating, or you're saying it doesn't necessarily have to do that. It could be just developing a more successful wetlands mitigation through a number of
options. Right. You could either try to have a more successful wetland mitigation, and it has been tough. Nationally, it's been very difficult to figure out, you know, what's the most effective way to make the mitigation a success. But you could also make the policy choice to say that we want to lower the risk of as we create more wetlands and increase the mitigation ratios. So it's really a balancing act.
Okay. Representative Krieger, follow up?
And over time, as we move forward, and we try to get Oregon's economy growing and try to do all the things to be business friendly, aren't a lot of these wetland mitigation sites going to be used up and they're going to be harder and harder to find that meet the criteria? I mean, there's not an infinite amount out there forever. Just, you know, if you're willing to throw your dollars out there, they're available.
Representative Krupp, Representative Krieger, you know, one of the things that we'll be talking about in a minute or two when we come to it will be the mitigation banks. And actually, we're seeing a substantial increase in the number of mitigation banks. Now, mitigation banks aren't available statewide. So that is one option. And actually, a mitigation bank is a very good tool to use because it's a larger wetland. It retains more of the functions than if you do like a little postage stamp mitigation project. But in some areas of the state, you're right. There are shortages of places where you can do good mitigation.
And in the interest of full disclosure, I will announce to in public hearing that I've actually had a Division of State Lands or our Department of State Lands out to my farm and my home to look at potentially creating wetlands on my particular area, because I have some lowland area that is appropriate for that. And so it is an area of interest to me personally, and I know I've talked with various farmers. You will find as agriculture is not an extraordinarily profitable enterprise these days, sadly, that there are farmers that are looking at this as a means of reducing their debt load on their lands over time without taking a lot of land out of production necessarily for them. So it does have possibilities, and again, in the interest of full disclosure, it is one of the reasons that I'm looking at it, is that, and I like to hunt ducks. So.
It's a ducky idea.
Yeah, it's a ducky idea. Yes, first and
foremost. So you get this squared away, then you got a farmer Krupp, and he has, you know, 10 acres that he'd like to, actually, you'll be restoring it into a well. It probably was a well, I know, already. That was a well.
Some, yes, some, no.
Okay. Yeah. You have that available, then the developer comes along and somehow they get hooked up and he pays the farmer X amount for how long? Forever?
Well, the developer pays one amount to the mitigation banker, right. And the mitigation banker then sells that person a credit or a fraction of a credit for a price. And then that developer's responsibilities for mitigation are taken care of. The mitigation banker does have to sign agreements and make sure that land for a mitigation bank is dedicated for a mitigation bank.
And not only that, it is a permanent deed restriction.
Yes.
If you can't convert that back to anything other than wetlands, so you've got to be responsible. And the other thing is that the individual who is the mitigation banker has to be fully aware of that they've got to make their mitigation bank successful. It's got to accomplish mitigation in a manner that is approved, and there has to be some management down the road. You just don't let it overgrow. You got to make sure it operates efficiently like it's supposed to. Yes?
Maybe I'm spending too much time on this then, but is it only certain degraded pasture land? Or is it, I mean, could you take, theoretically, could you take prime producing property that yields a lot of, you know, product, and for some, if it ever got to the point where you made more money off prime farmland being a wetland than you do, or being a wetland than you do on farming? You see, I mean, there's a lot of people sensitive about taking things out of production, but could that scenario come about, or is that highly unlikely?
Well, from my perspective as a farmer, I would say that the highly productive soils are not generally considered of this use. It would be your more poorly drained soils that don't grow the more productive crops that are a better candidate for this type of a circumstance.
And then what do you do if the developer goes broke or runs out of town? Or how do we manage?
Doesn't matter. The developer's obligation is ended when he writes you a check as the mitigation banker for those credits. He's done. He's over with. And the obligation of the mitigation banker is to continue to make sure that operates successfully as a wetlands in perpetuity. And that's why there's a permanent deed restriction on it.
Thank you.
To accomplish that. And by the way, I will say that also for the record that Division of State Lands has been out to my property one time. I've gotten no special treatment on this particular issue. I want to make sure that's clear and on the record.
Well, I wouldn't put up with that.
that was Representative Creek. You didn't know.
Mr. Chairman, I wasn't probing your.
No.
I just
want to make sure that this is clearly above board in every way for the record. So why don't we move on after having beat that one to death?
Okay,
move on to number 16 for while we finish up.
I want to point out that this one was recently split off from freshwater wetlands, because estuarine wetlands are really different than freshwater wetlands in terms of basically their functions and where they're located. I also want to be up front in saying that we haven't collected data for the last 2 years because we've had a real shortage of staff, and we've had a real push to try to deal with wetland delineations, like for the industrial lands, and for making sure we get the wetland delineations done for high projects. So I will be up front in saying it was a management decision that it was going to take a substantial amount of effort to collect the data over the last 2 years. What we've done to correct it for the future is that we're hoping that the method of data collection, now that it's been split off, will make it easier as we enter that into our data tracking system. So there was a reason why we didn't do that, because we really needed to detail staff off.
That was going to be my question, so you've answered that appropriately. Thank you. And so I also wanted to ask you, in the middle of the page, you say how does the performance measure demonstrate agency progress? Second sentence is, when data becomes available consistent with the revision which breaks wetlands into freshwater and estuarine benchmark, the department will have improved data and will analyze. So when do you think that will be then? Do you have a time frame for us on that? For the record again.
Mr. Chair, John Lilly, Assistant Director, Department of State Lands. We would think that within the upcoming biennium, we would certainly be able to fill these gaps. Anna's hit the nail on the head in terms of why there are the gaps and the workload requirements that we've had to do the wetland delineation reports to maintain our pace, and the statutory limitations that we have on making permit decisions.
Okay, so sometime in the 2005-2007 biennium, you would have completed the other issues that have, well, with your reorganization and working on the industrial sites, you'd hope to have some data for this. It is an important measure, and I'd like to see that measured at some point.
Oh, I recognize that very much. It's just sometimes when you have limited number of staff, you've got to make some decisions.
Sure.
How you allocate.
You understand
time.
That.
Sure.
Yes, Representative Zinko.
Thank you. Well, I just am curious, you know, having worked for the Oregon plan for the past 10 years, and they just completed the coastal coho assessment, I would think that this performance measure would link in really closely with the Oregon plan. And so I'm just curious where, you know, if how you're working with ODFW and the other agencies on that, because the $250 a year, I mean, I think that should be linked to part of a restoration, especially for the coastal coho. John's shaking his head, so I guess he's going to come up
here again. And this is very much dependent upon restoration. And one of the reasons it is much larger is that when you have restoration efforts, it does cover a lot of acres when they do a major restoration effort.
John Lilly, Representative Krupp, Representative Dinkfeller, you're absolutely right. We are coordinating very closely with the COHO project, and some of the data that we've collected for that report really will be useful for helping us update this chart here. And there is a lot of coordination going on in that regard.
Very good.
All right. Well, I think we can get maybe one or two more out of the way.
Okay. The next one is the percent of removal fill violations resolved. In this, the target was 50%. Our data showed that we resolved 37%. We closed about 140 cases per year. The decline in this has been due for several factors. One has been focusing more on meeting permit deadlines. We've also, in order to address this, we are reorganizing so that staff who actually deal with the permit issuance will deal with resolving violations too. So that person will be doing both. We had a couple individuals that were detailed for doing solely resolving violations. We also have had turnover in staff, which has made it more difficult to try to resolve some of the violations on as quickly as we've wanted to.
Thank you. You have percentage. Have the raw numbers of violations decreased, or where? What are they like? You just have the percent of violations per year, I'd assume. Have the violations, number of violations decreased, went up and down?
Representative Crawford of the Shoppers, Chief Purchase Assistant Director of the Department of State Lands. The number of violations are fairly static at about 600
a year.
That's complaints and violations. Not every complaint turns into a violation. Some are dealt with very quickly because there's not a violation. It's less than 50 cubic yards. It doesn't make a violation, those kind of things. So it's difficult to say, but it seems to stay pretty steady.
Thank you.
Sure. Dinkel.
I have a question regarding is this your staff or is it the AG's office, or at what point is it handed over to the AG's office trying to figure out if it would end up in your budget or the Department of Justice's budget?
If it's department, well, it's always come back, they bill us.
But how much of the work is your staff versus DOJ?
Steve, you want to answer that?
Sure. Representative Croft, Representative Dingenfelder, the Department of Justice only gets involved if there's a contested case. We are able to resolve most of our violations, I will say internally and externally, with the person who has done the violation. We are experiencing more contested cases than we ever have, but they're not all tied to violations. They're more tied to permit conditions or adjacent landowners who don't want to see those activities occur on their neighbors' lands. They're afraid of what the effect of flooding or erosion might be on them. So on our violations, we're not seeing that many actually go to contested cases.
Yep.
Well, I'd like to ask you to get us some information. I'd like to know what your numbers of violations are, and why don't you get them for the years of 03, 04, total number of violations both years. And then if you could, give us the aging of the violations. It doesn't say how long it takes you to resolve these violations, and then how many are carried forward from year to year, typically. And thirdly, if you look at the measurement of 2003, your target was 50%, and you achieved 30%, which is quite a drop. In 2002, you were at 45%. Year before that, you were at 64%. What happened in 2003 to drop you from 45% to 30%? And does that mean then that 70% of the violations were unresolved? And then do they carry forward into the next year, or how does that work?
Representative Croft, a couple of explanations. One is the high number of 64% and 51% in 2000-2001, and the drop has been related to really two major issues. One is the state legislature put a statutory deadline on us for issuing a permit. And with the staff that we have available, our focus became getting that permit issued within that statutory deadline that we were given to work with, because we did not receive an increase in staff to meet that statutory deadline. So our focus was on getting the permit issued. That meant less enforcement time, so the percent for enforcement resolution goes down. If a violation is resolved quickly, that's great for us. But typically a violation requires some kind of mitigation, or it could be a violation where we have stopped the activity, the applicant has to go forward and apply for a permit, do the corrective action in the permit application, and move on. And sometimes those take a year or two to get resolved. So we have a number of violations, I guess you could say, in the flux at any given time. And we'll try to give you an estimate of how many we think that is. And they do carry forward until they're resolved.
Yeah, I would have thought that they would. I'm just trying to get an understanding of what your workload is in this particular area, because you may need to readjust your target, and based on whatever resources the legislature offers you or what your reorganization can achieve. Senator Shields.
Representative Krupp, you asked several questions kind of in series, and while I agree that those are all good questions, I would think that you would want to complement your question with a further question about, you know, we're not just in the process of wanting to get through and close cases. We want to make sure that the state doesn't lose money in closing the case. You know, we're managing this land for the state school fund and so on, and so if it takes longer, and maybe it's a good thing that cases closed drop to 30%, because if we'd artificially kept ourselves to 50%, we might have been giving away some assets. We might have been, you know, surrendering more than we fairly should have surrendered. So what I'm saying is that there's quote unquote the rest of the story. You know what I'm saying? A few years ago we gave them a statutory deadline to do the permits without more staff. Therefore, they had to reassign staff to the permitting end. Therefore, they had less for the enforcement end. And it sounds to me all too much like, you know, going after deadbeat dads for not paying child support. When the Department of Revenue assigned a bunch of new attorneys to go after the deadbeat dads, all of a sudden we had more revenue coming in because we were catching people that weren't paying their child support. Thereby, and once we started catching them, we were able to reduce the amount of money we were spending on welfare. You know, so I'm just saying I see somewhat of an analogy here, and if I'm wrong, I'm still learning, okay? But I just want to make sure that we don't close cases to our own detriment, because we are managing this for the school fund.
Fair enough, and in that regard, actually, you prompted me to ask another question, Senator. Do you have an average length of time to resolve a violation? Can you come with an average length of time it takes to do that? Because you did mention a critical factor that sometimes there are mitigation that need to occur in other things, and that takes time to achieve. Sometimes that mitigation means you can only work in the summertime and you can do those things. So those are reasonable parameters to accept. So can you try to come up with maybe an average time for us to understand? Again, what I'm trying to drive at here is how big a problem is this for you as an agency, and how best can we address it? And secondly, when you come up with a time issue, try to translate that to dollars. Because how much staff time does it take to deal with a violation?
Representative Krupp, one of the things that I, you know, want to say is not all violations are created equal. And
of course not.
We have some violations where that have been more than
fair. Thank you.
been more that, you know, they correct themselves after we talk with them. Sometimes that has turned into fairly prolonged cases that have been contested cases or that have even gone into the Court of Appeals. So sometimes they can be resolved in a matter of days. We have a few cases that have gone on for longer than I'd like to see them go on for.
Okay. Well, again, I think that it would be good for us to, again, understand how big of a problem this is for not only the agency, but also for violators, for whatever reasons. This may be an area that we as a legislature may need to take a look at giving you more resources to resolve these issues in a more timely manner. So if you can try to put a average time and some kind of an average cost. Again, I'm just looking for ballparks here. I'm not looking for absolute definitive statistics, okay? I'm trying to get a sense of what's going on here. Representative Schaffer, one last question, and then we're going to close up.
Do you think, or would you come back and tell us if it would more staff go after violators? Is it possible for that to pay for itself or not?
Probably not.
All right, thank you. Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your. We got halfway. Well, yeah, almost halfway. A little over halfway. We did pretty good. So we'll finish up tomorrow with performance measures.
Monday,
right? Yeah. Well, I'm working tomorrow. Okay. But we'll finish up on Monday. Thank you all very much. Have a good weekend. We will see you then. We are adjourned.